Welcome back to A Friend Indeed. You are listening to the second part of our interview with world-famous friendship expert, Professor Robin Dunbar from the University of Cambridge. We ended our last episode with Professor Dunbar explaining that it's female family members who really are the last social connections left standing, and they're the ones who will last with you right until the end. And I wanted to ask him whether there was more generally any trends in terms of gender and the quality of friendship and friendship breakup.
All the work that's been done really on friendships, not just by us, but by other social psychologists, has led people to refer to female-female friendships as being much more fragile, that's the term that's been used, than friendships between males. Guys seem to have much more casual friendships. They're kind of here today and gone tomorrow. If, you know, if Jimmy goes off to, you know, Thailand or something like that for a year, well, you know, you've got a slot, an empty chair in the pub, and you just go and find somebody else to sit in. Anybody will do, as long as they can lift a pint glass. You know, it's that sort of sense of casualness, whereas women's friendships seem to be much more intense.
But it's interesting, the more intense the relationship is, the more likely it is to break up. How does that work?
Well, that's because these best friend relationships are in many ways similar in a psychological sense to a romantic relationship without the sexual element in there. And it's that intensity that causes the friendship then to be at risk if somebody does something to undermine it in some way. A failure to support you in an argument, you find out they've been bad-mouthing. And it's those breaches of that trust that cause friendships to be chipped away at and then eventually break if it becomes serious enough.
You mentioned that marriage, for example, being quite toxic for men's friendships.
It's not really toxic. It's just that I think this is a consequence of in that men's relationships are so casual, and women's are much more built around kind of organizing their own social world. That what seems to happen very often is the women or the wives, you know, sort of get together because they want to get together. And the husbands are kind of dragged along. So they become friends with the other husbands, where, again, largely a consequence of opportunity. But it's the women really determining who's the member of that club. And then the consequence of this becomes obvious then when the partner dies or there's a divorce, because suddenly the poor guy's lost most of his social network.
How do you learn how to sustain a friendship? Where does that come from? Is it from your parents, the relationship you've had with your parents or your experiences growing up? How do you learn that?
Your parents can tell you, you know, you must share your toys with these other nice little children and you might learn to behave a bit better as a result. But by and large, I suspect a lot of this learning goes on with peers. I sometimes describe it as, you know, being in the sandpit of life here. You know, what happens in the sandpit is somebody accidentally or deliberately kicks sand in your eyes, you know, and you can't get out of the sandpit. You have to deal with it. You have to learn the skills of how to cope. And that means knowing to recognize whether they did it deliberately or by accident. That's the beginning. And then how to diplomatically cope with the situation so that it doesn't escalate and get worse.
It's funny, I've never heard friendship quite described as a skill you have to practice and learn and observe. Like it's interesting. Everyone thinks it just comes to you and you could be a friend, but actually you're describing it in a very different way there.
They are very complicated. They actually, neurologically, they re- recruit huge quantities of neural processing time. Because I think what's going on here is you're actually modeling in your mind somebody else's mind, and maybe two or three people's minds at the same time. Because, you know, relationships aren't just one-on-one. They're not dyadic.
It's like a web you're kind of observing, isn't it?
Absolutely. So. And so it's sort of knowing how to sort of factor in all the consequences of your action. This is why people who are not kind of operate as kind of psychopaths, as it were, and lack this capacity to think first before they act, tend to be a rather unpleasant people, and B, not the sort of people you want as friends. To have effective relationships, you have to be able to kind of engage in very, very high level cognitive processing, and that's computationally, in terms of neural processing time, much, much more expensive than kind of conventional things like simple causal reasoning about, you know, what happens when a cloud gets very black. And the social world is just much, much more complex, and it's really I think just indicative of the fact that it takes you 25 years to become even half as skilled, in the sense that most of us are just half skilled adults, really.
Yeah, you know, I think it says everything, you know, doesn't it? Yeah.
It only takes you 5 years to become competent in language. I mean, most 5-year-olds have mastered most of language.
What's your feeling about the effect of the pandemic? Do you think there are more friendship breakups coming, or less as a result of it?
I think the you know, teenagers, those early years, particularly sort of, I don't know, we're talking about maybe 10 through to 25, are the big period of social learning. The social drive is so strong that they just bounce back as soon as the daughter's school is opened again. You know, it's much more likely to be a problem at the other end of life. The older people, you know, whose social circles are gradually declining because they're losing friends through death and so on. If they're not keeping up with the existing handful of friends they've still got, then and those friends get weakened, then they will seriously be in trouble, because, you know, they tend not to replace friends so easily.
I think you say in your book there's a real lack of research in this area. And what do you think warrants further study when it comes to this particular topic?
Oh, I think the lack of research is in kind of the wider network of friendships. So extending into the community side of the life we're embedded in, as it were, that's really missing. So given that our problem is ever-growing size of the population of the world and its increasing urbanization and higher levels of movement that go on, people constantly moving for jobs to new places, but they don't know anybody. And globalization, all these things are extremely destructive of our sense of contentedness with the community. And that's because our community is really a very small scale phenomenon. So somehow we have to figure out how these small scale communities, which we were kind of designed by evolution for, work, and figure out then how we can scale those mechanisms up to create a more integrated, more cohesive, larger scale, national, dare one say, international community.
Okay, it's recording. But I'm going to be stopping now.
You've made all your sandwiches.
Yeah, and then I'm going to be putting my washing out. The domestic goddess that I am.
Okay, good. So, obviously, we just heard the wonderful Professor Robin Dunbar, and I thought it was a lovely ending where he was talking about how friendship could change the world.
It's heartwarming, that ending bit. But I thought it was really interesting.
The bit that I thought was really interesting was the bit when he was talking about how you don't learn the skills, or you can't become a good friend. You haven't learned those skills until you're like 25. And even then, he was saying you're only half skilled.
25 is an interesting age, because neural networks, they sort of go through a stage of proliferation and pruning and massive growth. The first is in early years, sort of toddlers, and then the second time there's a mass pruning stage in adolescence, and then it sort of slows down. So that's why through puberty and adolescence there's thought to be a lot more impulsivity and things like that, because there's a sort of a really heightened brain growth and development. And in the sort of 24, 25, it starts sort of slowing down and settling.
But it is from adolescence when friends start becoming a thing as well, isn't it?
You're right. I think like the intensity of friendships in this, especially like in teenagers, it's like such, it's like a main task, isn't it? It's a main developmental task of those teenage years, is to sort of make friendships, bond, sort of connect, get into conflict, disconnect, all of those sorts of in and out of friendship groups, things like that, finding a place. But really, if you think about it, at the age of 25, you've had experience of obviously your family relationships and patterns, and then you've had experience of relationships outside of that, so from your peer group, from teachers, from, you know, other people in society. So, and in a way, it's like it's sort of, you're more able to probably also get a sense of who am I and what do I want to value in a friendship.
And just coming back to kind of what Professor Dunbar was talking about. So he was talking about like catastrophic breaks in friendship versus those that kind of fade out unconsciously. So I was kind of struck by that, because I think I've experienced both of those things, and they are very different.
Well, also particularly like the gender difference ascribed to it.
He was saying that women, wasn't he, that women often can have very close, intense friendships that then end up more predisposed to a catastrophic breakup.
I mean, I think, yeah, I've definitely had quite a few catastrophic ones.
Oh, goodness.
Often from me, from my side. As in, I probably could have done that a bit better. Probably could.
Well, you know, recently I've tried to resuscitate an old, very close friendship, and it doesn't work.
Yeah, but I also think what's interesting as well is that it would be really interesting to think, to take a poll of when the catastrophic endings happen in the life stage. As you get older, they're just not as, you know, there's just not as, I don't know how to say, you know, there's not as pressure.
Or you get better at choosing people.
But I think you choose less as you get older.
It's kind of like, you know, we've all dated disasters, and then you end up with someone, hopefully, that is not a disaster and you can live with. So it's kind of, it's the same, almost a similar process, weirdly. You kind of.
But you see, the thing is, what's interesting is you might have people that serially, throughout their lives, just have nightmare relationship after nightmare relationship after nightmare relationship after nightmare relationship, and they just have a series of relationships that are just shit.
Well, they're the ones who don't learn.
No, they're the people that probably don't necessarily have a framework for knowing actually how to be in a sort of a healthy relationship, because we don't always have that opportunity. Not all of us have that opportunity to have that model.
Talking about getting older, because he was horrifying what he was saying about getting older. So he was like, kind of, you know, everyone dying, and then you can't go out and meet people as easily, or you don't know quite where to go. And so I thought that was just horrible.
But it's just the reality, isn't it?
I know these things. It just reinforces for me that point, which Nick Hooper in the previous podcast was talking about, how being open and being... getting outside your comfort zone is really important, and probably as you get older, probably even more important to make sure you're still making social connections with people. Not necessarily very deep ones, necessarily, but at least you're still putting yourself out there, I suppose, I think. Okay, so this is the end of season one, so I'm just going to go through just a few kind of learnings, which I kind of thought, just from the...
No, wait, we've missed some things. Oh, okay. You have to do that again.
It's gone
so
now.
So we missed
finished.
About the parenting.
It's gone.
No, you have to just edit it in like you do with your magic.
Because that's an important point, as in, you know, parenting is, there's the explicit parenting, which is what we tell our children to do, you know, how we teach our children. And then the biggest form of parenting is the implicit parenting, which is how we are, our emotions, how we live in the world, day to day, our reactivity, our presence with our child, or how we interact with them. Those patterns are generalized then. Into all of our relationships.
You then take that model and then you look at, you could contrast it with different models and where it's, but it, you've still got one model, haven't you, that you've learned?
Yeah, or you might have a couple, you might have a few people, might have, you know, multiple different, you know, families.
I think the only thing I would say is you do, I mean, I think everybody behaves very differently when they're interacting with their parents.
Well, yeah, maybe that's what he was referring to then.
So we've come to the end of season one, and I think it's about time we review what we've learned from 10 episodes of this podcast. So one of the things I didn't properly appreciate, I suppose, was like the mental and physical benefits of having friends. I didn't really realise that was... I mean, you kind of know, it's, you know, instinctively that having friends is a good thing, but I didn't realise how powerful it was.
They do. They make such a difference to our lives.
Even I was reading the other day about even if you go for a walk and you say hello to someone on the street.
Does that surprise you though?
No, it doesn't surprise me. What surprises me, it's scientifically measurable that has an impact on you.
Yeah. Yes, it does. It has a massive... It's interesting. I was talking about this on the train this morning. I basically was busy stressing about day-to-day stresses, as we do, or often on the train. And I recognised the person, the woman's face sitting opposite me. And it turns out that we would often see each other on the train. And it's the first time that I'd seen her since lockdown. And I just... was so aware of how much I'd missed that, you know, like for like all of these months and months and months driving everywhere, you don't interact with anybody because when we're in our cars, we don't stop anywhere. So, you know, I realized that for like 8 months, I hadn't probably spoken to anybody on my journeys in and out, and how much I'd missed it and how much it made such a difference. You know, there's small things. You might think they're inconsequential, but actually they make such a difference. Because when I just realised how lonely it had been, I really realised how lonely I'd felt that whole time.
Right. And that kind of goes back to what you were saying about society, about how, you know, we're increasingly atomised generally. Anyway, moving on. Just to the second thing was really struck me is that it's come up several times in the podcast, but about the fluidity and of friendship, but actually the stability of certain friendships I thought has been fascinating. So those friends you kind of don't have to work at a friendship and just are always there, and you always get them and they get you, and it doesn't matter how long you've been apart, you can be in the same room and it's just like nothing's happened. And we've spoken to some people like that, like Pinar and Rebecca at the beginning, like the brain tumor twins. You still haven't listened to that one, but anyway, I'll forgive you for now. But those friendships where they've really just kind of fallen into friendship, and it's not hard at all. I think that's fascinating. And the third thing was about friendship being a choice. And I hadn't really kind of thought about this before, but it's about that's what makes friendship different.
But maybe it's also things where it's like... there isn't any contractual agreement, is there?
No, not like a marriage or...
So in a way, you can choose to finish it, start it, finish it whenever you want. So can I ask you, when you originally set up to do this podcast, now, you know, at the end of it, do you feel that, you know, is it as you expected?
Yes and no. I mean, some things about friendship are pretty obvious, like it's kind of... But when people say them, you're like, oh, yeah, I kind of understand that. And then other things are kind of like the whole 150 being the total and how people kind of slot in and come out and all that kind of stuff, and understanding the rings that of kind of closeness that you have. I never really had that structure to hang things on, I suppose. So speaking to people who've kind of researched it and looked at it in detail is quite interesting because they see it from a different angle. I don't know, what's been the lovely thing is just talking to some people like about their friendships. I think that has been lovely. And of course, talking to you, Rita, and all the other contributors, you know, it's been a really interesting season, I think. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Nigel. And it's really been a pleasure and a great experience sharing this journey with you so far. Looking forward to your further journeys. And, yeah, it's been really interesting, and thank you.
Yes, well, we hope to be back in next year, in 2022, so please do check us out, and thank you for listening. Bye-bye.